As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." John appeared, baptizing in the wilderness and proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. And all the country of Judea and all Jerusalem were going out to him and were being baptized by him in the river Jordan, confessing their sins. Now John was clothed with camel's hair and wore a leather belt around his waist and ate locusts and wild honey. And he preached, saying, "After me comes he who is mightier than I, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie. I have baptized you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit." Dwight McKissick wrote, "Our nation is ill at ease. The number one item purchased on Black Friday was guns. Ebola, ISIS, and terrorism are threatening us from afar. Questionable and controversial grand jury decisions have erupted into civil unrest within. Race relations, family life, definition of a family, church attendance, economic well-being, and optimism about our collective future are all undergoing serious revisions, doubts, and uncertainty daily." And the prophet cries, "Comfort, comfort you, my people." You know, one of the most difficult things about the recent reactions to these two grand jury decisions in our country relates to our ability to empathize. Now remember, empathize is different than compassion. Compassion is really kind of emotive move that kind of gets us to feeling a particular way about something, but doesn't always end up in action. Empathy is really the move that says, I not only feel it, but I'm going to enter it with you, and I'm going to participate in what could possibly be a potential solution. There is a difference. And when these sorts of things happen, these things erupt, and they're all over our television screens, they're all in our newspapers, they're in our news feeds on whatever we find on the internet, what really causes us an issue is how do we empathize? I'm careful to say this, but pretty confident that I can, that few of us have any black friends with whom we can have a conversation about to find out exactly how we could empathize with the particular feelings that they express when these sorts of decisions come down. We may say we know one or two, or maybe we would say, well, some of my best friends are. But the realities are we've never broached the sort of conversation with someone of color, of black color, to say, why such a guttural reaction to these decisions? What really is it that is prompting the way that you take these in and feel them very deeply? We instead form our own opinions from our well, safe, and secure positions in the world. But you know, if all we were concerned with was surviving the way the world was working, then these conversations probably wouldn't matter a whole lot. We come to worship, and most often, rather than being given an opportunity to take in what these things might mean, we would prefer to hear songs, sermons about a different future, one where the lion lies down with the lamb. We long to be encouraged by the fact that what we face in this world is but for a short time. We look for the roll to be called up yonder. It's as if for a moment we don't want to hear what's really going on in our world. We'd like to block out the noise. We want something of a spiritual Calgon moment. We don't really want to take into account always what the implications of a broken world look like, what it might mean to us, what we might need to do. And the prophet cries, "Comfort, comfort my people." A young girl, one of our own, made the Bedlam game yesterday. She was at the coin toss. Her parents, when she was born, had no idea that she'd ever toss a ball, much less stand on a field in the center of it with all eyes, all more than 85,000 people looking at her while those big towering athletes in crimson and cream and orange and black decide, well, who gets the ball first? And what direction would you like to go on your opening kickoff? No, they had no idea that young Grace would stand there on that field, a symbol of hope, probably lost in the midst of all the fanfare and all the discussions of what might happen once the game ended. Would Coach Gundy still be coach, or would it really be a four-loss season for the Sooners? No, there she stood signifying something far different than what might be played out on a field. You see, most of us live in the vicarious moments where we've chosen our favorite teams, we've chosen our favorite music, we've decided to go to places that distract us from the realities of life. We look to get away because being in the way or being in the way of what's going on in the world means we actually may have to take some account of it. It is our drug of choice to avoid periods of uncertainty. We need life to be more bearable. And the prophet cries, comfort, comfort my people. To say that our world is broken is an understatement, but so was the world in which Judah was experiencing life. In Israel, they ignored the world and even their own. Those in power consoled themselves with accruing more power, and those with wealth did all that they could to see if they couldn't secure just a bit more. And when they did, those who had power and those who had wealth, they ignored those in their midst who were not from here, who were from somewhere else. They ignored those who had no family to help them get by. It's what the prophet referred to when he said, listen, you are not paying attention and taking care of the widow, the orphan, the stranger, the foreigner in your midst. And as such, you are in a land flowing with milk and honey, with the greatest need for the bare necessities by others, only available by looking in from the outside, from the distant margins of life. You know, power always resides in the center. It's always in the middle. It's never on the edge. And it's a place where we can secure our safety, where we can allay our fears with the comforts of power and wealth. And the prophet cries, speak tenderly that her hard service is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned. But how? Like, what would bring a change to a world that's broken? What would bring a change to experiences where more people are on the outside looking in than there are those in the center who are making life better for just a few? And who? Is there someone who could bring that? Is there someone that we could look to? Is there someone that we could hope for? Someone who might come and whose coming might mean justice will roll down like mighty waters. And the prophet cries, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. From the edge and from the margins, it's where God comes. God doesn't come from the center. And it startles us when God comes from the edges because we don't see it coming. Because we expect God to come from the center because of the way we talk about power and because of the way power functions in our world. At the center, at the core, the idea that God could come from anywhere else but from those places, that He could come from any other way than those ways. Keeps us never seeing and never believing. What we expect is God to show up like the cavalry. We expect God to show up like the military. We expect God to show up with a force of power, a show of power, and a show of force. But the prophets, they describe something altogether different. And what startles us is, as we read those texts, we read Isaiah, and you could read on past verse number 11 in chapter 40, and you get the prophet using the very language that we would think would follow a military victory. We would think that surely if we're talking about all nations cowering before him, we would think someone raided the place. Someone finally marched in with a big enough army to say no more, because our associations with liberation come in the form of violence. They come in the form of power. They come in the form of tanks and artillery. And what happens in the prophets, they use language that describes the aftermath of that sort of event. But sometimes when we read that, we mistake those descriptions as simply using common language for the means. As if the prophets are saying, this is how God will come. But if God's not coming from the center, that's not how God will come. He'll come an entirely different way. He won't come like the cavalry. He won't come like the military. And he won't come in a show of force, because the prophet said he'll be like a bruised reed. He won't come in all the ways that we anticipate, expect, all the ways that might be visible to us, because God comes to us from the edges, from the margins. And Mark tells this story of Jesus, the beginning of the gospel, good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And you've read those introductory words to Mark at least once. Just now you've heard it. Maybe you've read it over and again as you've looked at Mark's gospel. Maybe it is your habit, I hope it is, at least once a year to read all the gospels. It would be a good thing to read them every month. It would be a good thing to read them, a bit of them every day. But what happens to us when we read the scriptures and we come to a place, we see this as mere introductory remarks. Here's how I'm getting started. We pay no mind to why in the world does Mark start differently than Luke or Matthew? Why no nativity? Why, when we come and put our nativity scenes out, or we see our creches out publicly displayed, why, oh why, is there no reference to Mark? Why only Matthew and why only Luke? Maybe Mark just didn't get it in time. But Mark was likely the first gospel. Mark's import, what caught his attention, was likely something much more than about how that part started. And he may have had something, well, he did have something more in mind. In fact, his words aren't just introductory remarks. His words are the words that set the stage for us to understand exactly how we ought to read the entire gospel. Those living in Mark's day, who would have been the recipients of this gospel, who would have read the story of Jesus or heard it read in their community gathering, because remember, they didn't carry around scrolls. They didn't carry around Bibles. They didn't have parchments that they kept in their back pocket, much less the thought of an iPhone with a Bible app on it. When they got together to talk about what's going on, they read together, they listened together, and they talked together. That's exactly how church was done. It wasn't really done like this, I'm sorry to say. It really would be done rather probably in a circle. It would really be done more when we were kind of gathered around and we said, hey, by the way, what do you think Mark's up to when he doesn't start with a nativity scene? When we don't have something we could set on our tables and go, oh, well, I know where the shepherd story comes from, and I know why the wise men are here, and that star up there, I know what that is. But there's Mark is absent, and why is Mark absent? We would have sat around together, and we would have heard someone announce the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And we would have looked one another in the face and said, just what is he up to? Is this really just words? Just words? Just words? Or are we supposed to read this as something entirely different? That this isn't just a cute story? This isn't just something that Voltaire said would pass within 100 years of his own life? Is there something really that lasts, that something that goes on? Would it be really something that matters that we read those words? Why those words? What's the peculiarity of those words? Well, if we read them as we were sitting there, maybe as Mark was being read to a community, we might have, our ears might have perked, and we might have immediately said, you know, we're accustomed to the margins. We've been living on the margins. We've not been in the seat of power, and we've not been at the center of wealth. And we long to hear something radically different, something that doesn't say, hey, you need to have more, get more, and own more. You need to make more, you need to make all the powerful decisions. You need to leverage your position to get in all the right places and stations in life. We want to be the kind of people who are those vast majority, not just in that day, but in our day. And we want to hear these words as something radical, something that can inspire, something that can motivate, something that catches our imagination and our attention that says there is a different way to live in the world. And so if you were a Jew and you happened to be wanting to follow Jesus and you heard in the beginning, maybe you would have heard the echoes of the Torah. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And all of a sudden, your ears perk up in RK, in the beginning, when it all started, when it all came into being. Maybe all of a sudden, this book that you had read, that you'd studied, that you looked at, that kept talking about a promise, something to come. Finally, you hear maybe someone's going to connect the dots and say, ah, something is beginning. Something is coming. And maybe if you were instead maybe a Gentile, maybe of one of those groups of people or those tribes in which Rome had actually tried to assimilate you and take you in and form you and shape you into a nice, good, faithful Roman citizen that made sure you paid your taxes and you made sure that those who were in power kept their seats and those who had their wealth kept their bank accounts healthy. Maybe if you'd have heard that then, you would have heard the words good news as though, oh good, things are going to stay as they are. Because after all, good news, that word euangelion, that word that the New Testament writers actually take away from the vocabulary of their day, is one that always went around in the Roman city-states to say, hey, we've got news. There's been a military victory on the Western Front. Everything's going to stay the same. And so you're glad because you hate change. You don't like difference. You don't want something to alter the way the world works and how the world is to be experienced. You want things to remain the same. But here you're sitting in a group of people and those with Jewish ears are piked because they hear something about a beginning, and those Gentile ears are all of a sudden perk up because they sense good news? Good news of Jesus? Has there been another military battle? Has there been a war that we didn't know about? Is there a fight going on that we hadn't heard of? I really want to hear what's going to be described next. And now, enraptured at what's to come, they hear these opening voices, and Jewish listeners and Gentile listeners alike are hearing something is beginning. There's been a victory, and it relates to this Jesus Christ, Son of God. And all of a sudden, Jewish citizens and Gentile citizens go, you mean to tell me someone is taking Caesar's place? For you see, already the emperors had already had their pedigrees adjusted to where they were recognized as deity. Caesar was described as the first Son of God, not Jesus. And so here we've got a story that's going to be told that's taking all the language of all the citizens of the empire, Jewish or Gentile. And all of a sudden, in the opening of Mark's little story about Jesus, he's got everyone who's looking for a radical difference. He's got their ear, we hope. And now we want to know what it is about this new person on the scene, this person who might supplant Caesar, this one who might be a different kind of king, because it's something that's beginning and it's something that signals a victory of some kind, and it represents a God movement, something that we've all been looking for, a promise that's been made. God's going to act. God's going to work. So Mark's little opening words are not just, oh, by the way, let me tell you how it all gets started. At the very outset, the very sentence that opens up his little book is to get our ears and our imagination to say there is a different way coming in the world. There is something that you've looked forward to, something you've longed for, something you've anticipated, something you've hoped for, because you have been relegated to the outside. And now there's news about someone who wants to invite you into their space and place, their victory, their new beginning, and their participation in the movement of God. And Mark stirs the imagination of what to come. As it is written, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way." And we sometimes think that these guys mindlessly wrote the Gospels, that they sat down and put their brain in neutral and someone began writing, and maybe it made some connection, but maybe really what happened is the Spirit had so enlivened their imagination about the person of Jesus that they wanted to craft a, such a story to capture the imagination that said, listen, the world is now a different place because Jesus has come. And so he took their tradition and he took their prophetic tradition, one that always intended to challenge things as they were. I know you like things as they are, right? You want things just to stay the same. Yeah. Well, we say we don't. We say we don't like the way things are, but we do very little to change how things are. Not just in our world, not just by making the right kind of lever pulls. Well, that would be like a different day of voting, like marking our ballots and running them through the machine. No, we're talking about something on a more personal, more micro-detailed kind of way. What about our lives? What about the decision we make that charts something new and something different in the way we experience the world and others around us experience the world? No, we really like things as they are. We lay claim to wanting different, but we don't do much that's different. We've found our places of comfort and it's like someone who has experienced chronic pain. Have you ever had this experience? If you ever experienced chronic pain, what you learn that the body is capable of doing is adjusting to that constant level of pain. Right, Doc? So I remember, it's been almost 12 years ago, waking up on a Sunday afternoon after a wonderful nap. Aren't you looking forward to that? I can tell. You're smelling the food, and then the nap is coming, right? And I remember waking up feeling this incredible pain. Couldn't find a place of comfort. I couldn't sit down. I'm glad no one snapped a photo because I had this contorted kind of thing going on. Could you get just the right place where I didn't hurt? I didn't have a shooting pain below my shoulder blade, and my whole shoulder and left arm and my pinky and ring finger and my left hand were numb, and I finally could get there, and I thought, well, something weird. I must have slept wrong. You've slept wrong, right? I thought, oh, that maybe that's it. And so all week long, it's bothering me. I go to play basketball on that Friday morning, and they throw me the ball, and usually I can catch it. Usually score with it, by the way. Just they're older. You know, I was pretty decent playing with the old guys, but the cue was they were old guys, you know, so they weren't back like I was playing with a bunch of flat-bellied young guys. And so the ball came in there, and boom, I couldn't catch it. I couldn't grip the ball. Played with an orthopedic surgeon, and I said, hey, Sean, I said, listen, I got this problem. Woke up Sunday. I don't know what it is, but, man, I described it. He said, you need to come in. We need to do an x-ray. So I ran home, showered, drove back into the city, and he says, well, you've got a problem. You've got a ruptured disc, and there's some fragments from that ruptured disc that those little fragments have turned into like rocks. They're in your nerve canal, and, well, you've got a problem. I said, so what's that mean? Well, I mean, we could give you a few shots, maybe make you feel better, but probably going to mean surgery. Well, I got to tell you, I'm an impatient kind of person. You may not know that about me, but I can be. Just looking for the amen section over here. And so I agreed to a shot. Hey, I'll take that shot. But if it doesn't work, Sean, we're scheduling surgery. I'm not going to do the three-shot thing. I know sometimes it takes three, but if I don't feel it after the first shot, then we're going to do something different. I go get the shot, no difference. I call him up and say, nope, schedule the surgery. It didn't work. Well, couldn't schedule it till March the 1st, 2003. Well, after about 4 weeks, man, I wasn't hurting as bad.
After 6 weeks, 2 weeks away from surgery, I'm thinking, maybe I'm a miracle person. Maybe my body that's not supposed to absorb those rocks, they're not there anymore, and I'm all going to be okay. A week ahead, I'm thinking, you must be Superman, because I feel like I could just do anything, right? So I asked Sean about it, and he said, oh, no. Those things don't go away. Your body had just increased its resistance to that pain. It had just kind of risen to the occasion, if you will. And by the way, that's what happens to us. We have an experience in life, we say, I don't like the way things are. I don't want them to stay the same. But what happens is we don't make the consequent decisions that anything could be different. And slowly and surely, we decide to just increase our tolerance level of the way things are. And so out of our mouths, we say, man, I really want things to change. But with our bodies and our minds, the place in which action takes place, we don't really do anything different. So you'll observe something may be different in just a bit when we observe the Lord's Supper together. We're instead of just talking about the fact that we need to do something, but we're not sure because we've kind of risen to the level where everything's really comfortable. And we're like, well, I don't really want that change to take place. And you see, that's what happens to us. It's what happened to Israel. They long for a new day, but by the time we get to Mark's day, by the time we get to Jesus' day, they talked about wanting something new, talked about wanting something different, but they really didn't because they had become acclimated, they had become accustomed. They didn't realize the world still needed something radically different, something radically new. And so Mark, he appealed to the prophetic tradition. He did a mashup of Isaiah and Malachi. I know, the text says, as it is written in Isaiah, but it's a mashup of the prophetic tradition. Isaiah happens to be the one that gets more notice. He's the one who kind of really is the place and the location where all this voice of one in the wilderness is. But the part about I'm going to cause my messenger to pass before or go before your face is Malachi. And so before we get real technical and go, well, Mark didn't know what he was talking about, we need to say Mark's appealing to the prophetic tradition. One thing we know about the prophets is they weren't afraid. They weren't afraid to say to those in power and who could control the way folks' lives were experienced, they weren't afraid to say, you're wrong. Something's got to be different. And so he appealed and he said, listen, behold, I'm going to send my messenger before your face. And we could read that one of two ways, and we're about out of time. We got some guests coming for lunch, and we don't want them to have to wait in the foyer. So what happens is in this particular prophetic move, that we could read this, that this is, if this were being written to Jesus, it would be a statement that said, God is going to cause John the Baptist to pass before Jesus' face to prepare the way for Jesus. But this is Mark's gospel, and while that would work and that would help fit the story and that would explain kind of what's happening when we talk about John the Baptist being the forerunner, it explains verses 9 and following. But if you're sitting in that fellowship, that community, in the circle, and you're hearing John's gospel and you've all of a sudden been signaled that something radical is going to be described and something is beginning anew and that there's this victory, and not just this victory, but it's a God movement that's at the heart of this victory. You hear the prophetic thing and you go, maybe that's for us. Maybe the prophetic tradition was invoked so that we would hear those words. And I'm going to cause my messenger, Jesus, to go before you, your faces, to make a way for you. Oh. Think about that for a minute. You see, we read the story and we quickly only read the text as though there's only one option. I think it's both. I think it certainly describes that John was what we call the forerunner, the waymaker for Jesus. But listen, for those who are hearing the radical nature of this victory of the God movement in Mark's day, they needed to know someone had made the way for them. that there's a new way in the world to live and to experience life and the realities of it. There's a new way to relate to everybody around you. There's a new way to talk about peace and hope. There's a new way to talk about the future. And just maybe Mark intentionally calls on the prophetic tradition and he says, listen, I'm telling you, I'm challenging you. You've got complacent. You've got comfortable. You've elevated your tolerance level to the way things are. And I'm telling you, someone has made a new way, a radically new way, a new way that represents the movement of God, a new way that brings victory. One, you can invoke all the language you want to of what happens after a military victory, but it doesn't come with the same sort of violence, the same sort of power gesture. In fact, what we're going to talk about is the power of love, and we're not going to fall into the trap of thinking that we love power. Instead, we're going to read about this story about where love really does take up residence in a real-life human being, and when it does, it changes everything. And we can talk about the consequences in language you and I understand, that nations will cower in His presence. Why? Love can do that, folks. You know, it's always easy to hop on the old interwebs and find someone who's thrown up some video about something terrible that's happened, right? But don't you like it every now and then someone shoots a video and posts it that something really good goes on? Or you read it in the newspaper if you don't even know what an interweb is, and you find out that there's a good story. And you say, man, we need more stories like that. We need, and all of a sudden, you feel that. Instead of feeling the tension of those negative stories, you feel the emotion of that feel-good moment. You say, there really is hope in the world. Someone really does take it seriously. Someone really does value another human being. And you get that, you know how that tingling feeling starts at the base of your head and just kind of gives you the goosebumps? You're going, wow, there really is hope in the world. And that's precisely the way that is made in Jesus. And so Mark appeals to the prophetic tradition when he talks about John the Baptist. And he says, I'll send my messenger before your face. And here we are now, a new way is made. And if we want to live into that prophetic tradition, we need to be those who will say in response to comfort, comfort my people, we need to be the people whose voices are heard saying, your hard service is over. Your hard service has come to an end. By the way, that's good news. Because in that language, it's the language of pardon. Now, you do realize pardon is at the whim of the pardoner. Yes? Pardon doesn't come because you've kind of met some sort of thing. When a name is taken to a governor or to a president for a pardon, it's to their whim to pardon. Now, certainly a case is made for all the things and the ways in which some sort of process has been entered for rehabbing a figure, a villain, if you will. But it still is in the pardoner's power to pardon and could hold everything against that person as long as they had that control. And here we are in that prophetic tradition, hearing the call, comfort, comfort my people. And we need to be the ones who say, your hard service is ended, you've been pardoned. And what has brought that reality? Well, Jesus. See, that's why we announce the good news. That's why we declare victory. We say, listen, there has been a victory, and you've been locked in a battle, and you've been experiencing the violence of life and the violence of sin. And there's a radically new way out there in the world, and it is the beginning of the good news in Jesus. Don't you like it that it's the beginning of the good news? It didn't say the end of the good news. It's the beginning of the good news. It's that here it starts and it just keeps going. So if we read that in that second way, Jesus has paved the way so the victory gets to be told over and over again, and it's always the beginning. And for someone, it's always the beginning of something new. And the prophet cries, every valley will be lifted up, and every mountain hill made low, and the uneven ground will become level, and the rough places a plain. And we look at that guy who ate locusts and honey, who went out in the wilderness, and it was the very place from which Jesus came after his baptism, from the margins to the people in the margins to say, there is a new way, there is a new day. And when we get together around the Lord's Supper table, the communion table, that's what we're celebrating. We're celebrating a victory. We're celebrating a victory that we may use language to describe its effect as though there had been some sort of, you know, warring event. But what event took place was the giving of a life. A life in solidarity with everyone who's been longing for a new day to come, for things to be different, to not be shackled, nor oppressed, nor neglected, nor expelled to the edges. But we celebrate that story where love took up residence in Jesus, gave his life, suffered for that radical new way, and was resurrected and affirmed to be the Son of God, the Savior of the world. So it runs right in this morning that we ought to live our lives through the promise. It's still present. And in our present, we ought to live by that promise. In the beginning, there is really something to look forward to. The beginning of the good news, a victory's been won. It's been won in Jesus, and it's a God movement. Now, what will we participate in? Things as they are, or things as they will be.